Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew. And the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's May the 20th, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
Rising of the moon. There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen. Far above their shining weapons, on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune.
Okay, first a word of warning. If you like these podcasts, make sure that you download them onto your own computer, back them up, and hang on to them. I don't want to get into a long paranoid rap here, but the possibility always exists that they may not be available from their original source at some time in the future, so I'd like as many people to own or possess copies of all these Radio Free Northwests as possible. They may become collector's items, maybe even illegal collector's items. So guys, if you can see your way clear, don't just listen to these casts off our server. Try actually to download them onto your own hard drive, enough said. Our first email this week is from a new contact in Georgia. Greetings, Comrade Harold. My name is Trenton. I reside somewhere around the vapid cesspool of human filth and depravity that is the city of Atlanta, Georgia. I've considered myself a white nationalist for some time now, and I've been racially conscious as long as I can remember, but I'm fairly new to the Northwest migration movement. Over the course of the last several weeks, I've downloaded and listened carefully to each of the Radio Free Northwest podcasts, and I must say that I'm quite happy to have discovered them in this movement. I have several questions regarding comments and points you've made through various podcasts, but I'd like to first ask about two specific points of intrigue for me. The first is a comment you made in Episode 8, right around minute 26, in the midst of what I would call a rant about the supposed freedoms we as white men and women have. The quote is as follows: "The neocons wave their red, white, and blue Masonic dish rags and babble about all this freedom we've got, etc., etc." In the context that the word was used, coupled with the tone in which you used it, my thinking is that there is some negative connotation to Freemasonry in regards to the movement, our cause, or whatever the case may be. If possible, could you elaborate on this? I know somewhat about Masonry, but haven't yet made the link to its effect on the movement. Well, the subject of Freemasonry has been one of the favorite topics of conspiracy theorists of all kinds for centuries. It's a very complex subject, Trenton, a very long story that I will make as short as I can, although, like a lot of complex issues, it's kind of hard to distill into a few paragraphs. You might say that the Freemasons are the Jews' Gentile auxiliary division. Leaving aside all their horse dung about going back to the time of the building of the first temple in Jerusalem, modern Freemasonry dates from the 18th century, and it is a variation on the original Jewish conspiratorial secret society, which was called the Illuminati, which was founded by a Jew named Adam Weishaupt in the 1770s in Germany. The object of this secret society, or order of educated, wealthy, and powerful men, was to overthrow the governments of the time, which were headed by princes and dukes and whatnot in those days, and replace them with a kind of middle-class people's republic, or commune as they called it, run by lawyers and effete intellectuals, although that is, of course, a pretty gross oversimplification, kind of like Arianna Huffington and Gore Vidal trying to take over the government. That was actually the original left-wing or communist or liberal view of what the great egalitarian paradise would be like. The nobility and the aristocracy were to be overthrown and murdered, and they were to be replaced not by the later Marxist so-called dictatorship of the proletariat, but by middle-class intellectuals such as most liberals are even to this day. In Weishaupt's time, it was mostly lawyers who were just as sleazy back then as they are today. You may have noted in the past that there are, in fact, very few actual working class people in the ranks of world liberalism and leftism. It's always these affluent, artsy-fartsy pseudos who think they know better than anyone else how everybody has to live who want to impose their ideas on the rest of us. You might say liberalism is a luxury they can afford. People who have to work for their money are almost always conservatives and right-wingers. You can see this split today between the Democrats and the Tea Party people. Now, the original Illuminati were broken up by the authorities in several German principalities a few years later for various acts of treason and subversion, but Weishaupt himself escaped and the organization simply went underground, and down through the years it morphed into a number of other clandestine groups, and they're still around today as thingummies like the Bilderbergers, the Club of Rome, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Skull and Bones Society, so forth and so on. One of these spawn of the Illuminati were the Freemasons. As an aside, I sure wish us white racial types could learn the art of conspiring as successfully as the Kikes have done for centuries. The big success of what you might call the Freemason OGs, the original Weishaupt crowd, was the French Revolution in the 1790s, in which hundreds of thousands of people died over a period of about 10 years. I don't know if you've ever heard of a man named Robespierre, but he was reputed to be a Freemason, as were many of the leading proponents of what was called the Reign of Terror. I say reputed because, unlike the movement, these guys really do know how to keep a secret, and it's sometimes difficult to tell if a historical figure was a Mason unless the man in question openly admits to it during his lifetime. The French Revolution not only slaughtered thousands of so-called aristocrats, but anyone else who stood in their way, including doctors and scientists and teachers and university academics who opposed them. In other words, any educated man who might have stood in their way. And that as well set a precedent for communist and left-wing revolutions to come. One of the ways an educated man in those times could escape the guillotine was by becoming a Freemason. It's known that a number of the founding fathers in this country were Freemasons, and you can still see a number of Masonic symbols on Federal Reserve currency, such as the all-seeing eye over the pyramid. It is also known that many of the non-Jewish figures in our ruling elite today, especially in Europe, are members of Masonic orders of various kinds, and this is why I tend to refer to the American flag as a Masonic dish rag. Today, most American Masonic lodges are harmless. They're kind of like the stonecutters on The Simpsons, where everybody just gets together once a month to mumble a few rituals, which they have no idea at all what they mean, and then get drunk and play ping pong. Some Masonic offshoots, like the Shriners and the Oddfellows, are in fact legitimate charities. But there are other Masonic organizations which are still pretty sinister. In Europe, the bad ones are the Grand Orient Lodge and the P2 Lodge, which is based in Italy, which was involved in all that Vatican murder and buggery and financial finagling back in the 1970s and 80s. If you're into that, you can Google the names Roberto Calvi and Michele Sindona and see what you come up with. For more information about the early days of Freemasonry, you will need to actually locate and read some books, which I know most Americans have a problem with. The books I would recommend are Proofs of a Conspiracy by John Robison, written in 1798, and The French Revolution by Nesta Webster, written in 1920 or thereabouts, I believe. I don't think either of these works are available on the internet, so you'll have to track down and order the actual books themselves. You might start with alibris.com, that's alibris.com. I say again, this is a very complex topic, and there are writers and conspiracy theorists who have based their entire careers on doing nothing but gassing on and on about Freemasonry. I don't have time to bloviate about it here. If you're really just fascinated by Masonic conspiracies, email me and I'll see if I can dig up a few websites for you. Back to Trenton's email. My second inquiry comes from your latest podcast, episode 16. In it, you explain your rationale behind the Northwest constitutional ban on abortion. I agree with you in saying that there is no justification for the murder of a white child. This got me thinking, however. Under Section 1, Article 7, I see mention of the ability of the state to revoke or reduce the citizenship of any persons with medically certified mental defects or insanity. Assuming that a mentally retarded white person is still permitted to live within the homeland, albeit with limited citizenship, does the Constitution of the Northwest permit them to reproduce? And for that matter, what of whites with genetic defects that lead to physical deformities, i.e. being born minus a limb or other such effects? My first assumption would be no, but a bit more clarity on the subject would be greatly appreciated. Okay, that is to some degree one of those many bridges that we're going to have to cross when we come to it, but my general thinking is this. First off, insanity is insanity. If you think you're Napoleon, or if you hear voices in your head from God telling you to shoot people, you are obviously incapable of exercising your political rights of citizenship in a responsible manner. As to birth defects and retardation, I think that once we have a sane and healthy society and a clean environment free of all the various toxic substances that capitalism pumps into the food and the water and so on, and that once we're eating a diet that consists of actual fresh food, vegetables, and meat grown and raised in our own country and not chemically processed crap like too many of us eat now, we will have a lot fewer problems with genetic defects and mental retardation and that kind of thing. We live in a world today that is toxic in every sense of the term, physical, moral, and chemical. And once we bring that world to an end, we will be astounded at how many problems we've lived with all our lives simply disappear. My own attitude towards the handicapped is that any kind of physical deformity or defect can be dealt with so long as the mind is not affected. Stephen Hawking is a good example. You can be a quadriplegic in a wheelchair and still be brilliant and make a constructive contribution to the world and enjoy life. The brain, the mind, is the seat of the soul, so to speak. In the case of Down syndrome and other kinds of genuine mental retardation, that falls into the category of cross the bridge when we come to it and avoid public speculation or discussion on it, because anything we say will be picked up on by the enemy and will be twisted and perverted and used against us. Always remember that we are trying to build a revolutionary movement under fire, at least figuratively speaking. Always remember that we're being watched and monitored, and they're making the rules. Some of those rules are that white nationalists of any sort, but especially real racialists like us, are not allowed the luxury of casual off-the-cuff comments. We're not allowed to make jokes or to have a sense of humor. Always beware of what you say in jest, in public, and even in private, because what you say in jest may be seized on and reported as dead serious. We're not allowed to hypothesize or to speak in theoretical terms. We are not allowed to think out loud. We are not allowed explanations, and we are not allowed do-overs. This applies especially to me as a party spokesman, but also to everybody else. We must never let slip certain casual words or ideas or speculation or words in internal debate in any form that can be overheard by the enemy, because those words will be immediately seized upon by Morris Dees or the ADL or whoever and used against us forevermore. You understand what I'm saying here, Trent, all of you? We are being monitored by evil people who seek to do us harm and exterminate our race from the face of the earth and who have the power to do so. One of the rules of the road in our fight to survive is there are certain issues we simply do not broach in public, or better yet, in private, because they can serve no useful purpose in implementing the 14 words and can only cause confusion. One of our greatest character-related needs is moral clarity, and we mustn't muddy that up with things that, at the end of the day, are not really relevant. Trent, I know this answer of mine sounds obscure and confusing in itself. Good, it's supposed to. See if you can read between the lines. Next email. This is from Dean in Oregon. Dear HAC, your latest Northwest radio cast was quite good up to your continuing eloquent presentation. The new look of the website is excellent. I really like it when you go after the organs who may be listening. Here's a couple of ideas that you may already have thought of. Number one, there must be small and even medium-sized business people in the Northwest who have some inkling of what's going on and even may have basic agreements with the Northwest Front. Having lived and worked in the Northwest my entire life, I know they're out there. The idea is, could individual front members make contact with prospective employers in their areas, present the basic Northwest Front program, and find if they would be willing to hire people who live outside the Northwest U.S. and are willing to move if work can be found? Yes, I agree, Dean. That would be a very good idea. Give it a shot in your locality down there and let me know how it turns out. Guys, I warn you, don't come to me with an idea, because the first thing I'm going to tell you, if it's a good idea, is, hey, that sounds like a really good idea. Let me know how it works out for you. I'm sure this wasn't Dean's intention, but just for the record, I don't want to hear, Harold, you should do this and you should do that. What I want to hear is, Harold, I have done this and I will do that. I need to be hearing that first-person pronoun a lot more than I do. Remember, you can't spell independence without I. Okay, getting back to Dean's email. Suggestion number two. There must be a lot of single men and women looking for mates who have in common their idea of building a whiter and brighter future for themselves and their future families here in the Northwest. Would it be possible to have, as part of the Northwest Front website, a feature for single young whites looking for future mates? This may be a way of getting more true whites to move to the Northwest if people outside the homeland could find a mate here. Oh boy, that's a loaded one. The short answer is yes, I would certainly consider that to be a worthwhile endeavor, and I will run it by our webmasters and see what they can come up with. But there will be all kinds of problems. The first problem is that any site like that, anywhere, will be overrun with nutcases and internet games players of both sexes, and I don't want internet games being played with our sites in any fashion. So we're going to have to figure out some way to be serious about a singles page or whatever it is we come up with. We need to understand that once something like that is up, it will be a magnet for internet kooks and weirdos, not even necessarily racial or anti-racist ones, just the huge number of flaming, raving kooks out there in cyberspace. The second problem is one I will just touch on here because I did get into the male-female thing at some length last week, and I don't want to develop into a broken record on that subject, so I'll just comment briefly. Assuming we could somehow find a way to restrict such a site to genuine, serious white nationalists who really want to hook up, we would discover that men would outnumber the women by about 6 or 7 to 1. I won't go so far as to say that racially conscious, single, uncommitted, and accessible white females of childbearing age don't exist, because no doubt they do, but it will take a major effort to find them and get them online in any kind of internet page or service like that. I've read some media interviews and other things down through the years put out by many so-called legitimate dating services, Match.com and so forth, and the one thing they all agree on is that the kind of mate or date seeker who is the most rare, practically dating service gold, is a single, height-weight proportional white female in her late teens or 20s who is seriously looking for a lifelong husband and father for her children. Apparently, white girls are too busy living in city apartments and clubbing and enjoying their babehood and mudsharking and working on their careers to show the guys how strong and independent they are, whatever. It looks like our shaven-headed and tattooed and video game-addicted Beavis and Butthead young men aren't the only ones who are throwing away the best years of their lives. With women, it's generally around 36 or 37 when they realize that they don't have a career, all they've got is a job, and the biological clock is running out and their babehood is coming to an end. That's when they start to get panicky and finally start looking seriously. Some guy in the movie industry, probably some Jew, once said that white women in Hollywood have three ages: hot babe, district attorney, and driving Miss Daisy. And maybe an internet site like Dean describes could get us a few district attorney-age white women who'd still be good for a child or two, I don't know. I will, however, take up the idea with our web people, running up the flagpole and see who salutes. In the meantime, I might recommend that everyone check out our party's internet forum at www.northwestrepublic, that's all one word, www.northwestrepublic.com. You might be able to do a little networking in there. Okay, first music break. Regarding historical, march, and other music from the good old days, the 1920s and 1930s, I have not yet found a version of the Horst Wessel song that I really like on the internet. There's one in particular I'm looking for that I can't find. Of course, all of them are original recordings from the Third Reich, and so they all sound scratchy and tinny to us today. No modern versions are available, at least not that I've found. It's worth about 10 years in prison just to sing it out loud in Germany today, never mind record it with modern digital recording equipment. Anyway, what I did find was the Führer Adolf Hitler's personal favorite march. I believe, if memory serves, it was the official unit march of Hitler's regiment during the First World War. This is the Badenweiler March. This is from Charles in Montana. Mr. Covington, I have read all of your novels and books, and I mean all of them. I believe I had what is termed Covington novel compulsive disorder in the medical literature, followed by a severe case of Covington novel withdrawal syndrome. All kidding aside, I really liked the historical novels and The Iron Dream, but I really had an epiphany when I got to the Hollywood Takedown. That was in The Brigade, for those of you who haven't read it yet. I'm really interested in your Northwest Front movement, and I think you're really out in front of the pack on this. I've known certain comrades he mentions here for a number of years, and they can give you some deep background on me. And by a strange series of coincidences, I'm now working in the homeland, not far from Kalispell. Since it's in the homeland, I guess I need to find out how to pronounce that. Yeah, I hear from a lot of people who just finished their last book of the quartet, complaining that there is no more. Well, actually there is, sort of. Just a reminder for those of you who came in late, and that means most of the people who are hearing this, that while it's true that I'm mostly well known for the four Northwest novels, and that insofar as I'm remembered at all, it will probably be for those four books, you know, there are other Covington books as well. I've written 9 other fictional novels and 1 long political and racial polemic called The March Up Country, as well as an anthology of my best articles that I call Dreaming the Iron Dream, and they're all available on Amazon.com. My fiction ranges from historicals to murder mysteries to ghost stories, but the closest to the Northwest novels for movement people would be 2 books I wrote during the 1990s called Fire and Rain and Slow Coming Dark. Those are the 2 Matt and Heather Redmond novels, both of them detective and or thriller-type books, but with strong white nationalist undercurrents. Both of these books were written years ago before I went totally Northwest, but you can kind of see me building up to it. I tend to hang on to my characters once I create them, and some of you may recall that Matt and Heather and their daughter Tori and the character of Bill Clinton's illegitimate son Bill Vitale made a few cameo appearances and had some offstage references in the Northwest novel as well. Now, these 2 novels are not anywhere near as racial as the Northwest novels, not by a long shot, but they certainly do have very strong racial and political connotations. In Fire and Rain, I take my shot at the wonderful left-wing mythos of the 60s and the anti-Vietnam War movement, and in Slow Coming Dark, I take on the Clintons. However, there is something you guys need to know about the first book, Fire and Rain. I mention this because the subject came up recently, and one of our comrades got kind of upset by some of the things he read in there. Every time I myself send out or give away a copy of that book, I include with it a sheet of paper which contains the following caveat and disclaimer, and I would like to read that to you now. Dear racial comrades, I'm enclosing a copy of my novel, Fire and Rain. I hope you find it an entertaining and enjoyable read. However, before you begin the book, I'd like a quick word. Fire and Rain was written with the intention of submitting it for publication through the existing publishing establishment, which consists for all practical purposes entirely of Jews, feminists, and the 6 or 7 multinational corporations who control the industry. The manuscript would have had to pass muster, at first by a literary agent who, whatever his personal political views, knows full well what the industry will publish and what it will not. Secondly, it would have to pass through a succession of readers, mostly leftist women and homosexuals. Then it would have to be accepted by an editor who would submit it to a board of other editors and market analysts, who would decide not only if the book was politically correct, but whether it would make any money. As you will see when you read it, the chances of Fire and Rain passing any such process of literary kosherization is slim indeed. But I was determined to try, and so I included in Fire and Rain a number of elements of political correctness that you, as an Aryan racial nationalist, will find disturbing and displeasing. I also deliberately included a couple of raunchy sex scenes. These are known in the publishing trade as commercial dirt. It is now virtually impossible to publish any work of fiction without them, and I had to include something of the kind were I to have any hope at all of getting the book past the politically correct gatekeepers of contemporary fiction, such as it is. Unlike its sequel, Slow Coming Dark, Fire and Rain was not intended primarily for movement readers. It was frankly an attempt to slip some political incorrectness past the system and make some money while doing so. In fact, it failed. Fire and Rain was rejected out of hand by every literary agent I submitted it to, including one who had attempted to sell several of my other novels and who sent the manuscript back with a note which read in part, "Harold, you know better than this. I like your work, but I'm not going to commit professional suicide for you." Comrades, the racial and political message is there in Fire and Rain. Read between the lines, recognize my politically correct interpolations as the clearly intended camouflage which they are, and understand the deeper meaning of the novel. Despite its many imperfections, I think you will find it worthy of a place on your bookshelf. The specific elements of political correctness I put into the book, only in passing I might add, were lesbianism and race mixing in the form of my protagonist having been briefly married to a Mexican in his past. I thought about this long and hard at the time. How to include the bare minimum necessary of PC crap to slip through the litmus test. And as revolting as those two specific things are, I found that they were the ones I could come closest to stomaching sufficiently to include them in the book. I didn't like doing it. Those aspects still disturb me when I reread Fire and Rain, but I have explained why they're in there and they can't be undone. Rather than try and address this to the one gentleman who found the book disturbing, let me just say what I've got to say about it, and then you guys can read it for yourself if you're interested. If you don't like it, if you think it indicates that I'm in some way spiritually corrupted because I could write such things, that's your opinion, and I won't try to argue with you. You may well be right. Like everyone else, I've lived all my life in a cesspool swarming with all kinds of vile and filthy things, and it would be remarkable indeed if I were not at least somewhat contaminated by it all. I have just read to you the reason why I wrote Fire and Rain the way I did, but let's look beyond that a bit. In my historical novels, I try my best to write about the world the way it really was. In the Northwest Independence novels, I write about the world the way it should be. In the two Matt and Heather books, I write about the world the way it is, and it's not a pretty picture. A writer is, or should be, primarily a storyteller. Whatever political or social commentary or point he's trying to make has to be secondary to the story itself and the characters, because if they're not believable, then his real point will be lost or made so ineffectively that it won't convince anyone who isn't already convinced. If he does a slapdash, sloppy job, he's preaching to the choir, as it were, and we do way too much of that as it is. He has to be able to construct his plots realistically, as events that might really happen, and he has to be able to empathize with his characters enough to understand them and present them realistically, even if he doesn't particularly like them. The complaint about my writing from a certain minority of movement people, not goat dancers, but genuine people who have a genuine problem with some of it, is that I seem to empathize a bit too much with some characters and situations. In all honesty, at this point, I should admit that there are other areas of my fiction wherein I've been accused of writing about certain subjects with a little too much gusto and empathy. There's a smart-ass nigger sidekick in my Civil War murder mystery, Bonnie Blue Murder, who is there for the very same reason. I had to have something to try and slide a Confederate detective hero past the PC filters. That one didn't work either. But I still stick one of those disclaimer sheets in the book every time I send one out. I've been accused of being pro-Jewish of all things because of Whisper Her Name on the Wind. I'm damned if I can see how anybody could possibly read that novelette and draw that conclusion, but one risk of being a writer and publishing what you write is that other people are going to see things in your work that you didn't put in there and never intended. Most readers, especially men, really seem to enjoy The Black Flame, my medieval murder mystery, but I've had a few accuse me of being some kind of secret sadist because of all the hangings and torture and cruelty in it. It's kind of hard to accurately depict the 15th century without those things, but I can get their point. Sort of. Some people objected to the language used by my gangster characters in the second Matt and Heather novel, Slow Coming Dark. I researched that one by reading transcripts of the John Gotti wiretaps and bugged conversations in the Ravenite Social Club in Bensonhurst. What can I tell you? That's the way wise guys really talk. If I had my mobsters using expressions like, oh, fudge, it would really have been a joke. All I can say, once again, is that these objectionable parts of my novels are there for a reason. They are the sweet candy coating on the outside that I hoped would fool establishment literary agents and editors into swallowing the bitter pill of racial and political truth inside. Like I said, it never worked. Editors and literary agents aren't fools, especially the Jews along the way of that editorial and publication process I talked about, and they obviously picked up on what I was doing. Then print-per-order publishing came along, and all of a sudden, back in 2000, I recognized that I could actually write what I wanted and not have to worry about passing political or racial litmus tests. From that moment on, I have never included one single item of PC in any of my fiction. Beyond all that, I don't know what to tell you. Whenever a writer publishes his work, there are going to be readers who don't like it. All I can ask of you guys is to read the books, and if you think there's something in there that is just so horrible that it negates and cancels out my four Northwest books and the millions of words of nonfiction, racial, and political material I've written over the past 40 years, best of luck to you, and I hope you find the standard of moral purity you're looking for out there somewhere. I'm not too sanguine about your chances, though. Second music break. Last week I played a modern version of a traditional ballad sung by Lorena McKennitt. Got a lot of good response on it, so I figure I'll go for an encore. This is a very old English ballad that became a very old Appalachian mountain ballad called Barbara Allen. This is Emmylou Harris.
Was in the merry month of May, when all gay flowers were blooming, sweet William on his deathbed lay, for the love of Barbara Allen, he sent his servant to return to the place where she if your name be Barbara, so slowly, slowly she gets up, and to his bedside going, she drew the curtains to one side, and says, young man, you're dying, I know I'm sick and very slighted Barbara. He reached up his pale hands, intending for to touch her. She turned away from his bedside and says, young man, I won't have you. He turned his cheek due to Barbara. She had not
quick interjection here. We need to start working on ways to avoid the 9-month syndrome. Now, back in the day, it used to be the 18-month syndrome, but the internet has accelerated everything. What I'm talking about is this common pattern where someone reads the Northwest novels and contacts me absolutely afire with enthusiasm. They want to pack up all their stuff and come home to the Northwest right away. They just can't wait, so forth and so on. Then they start trying actually to organize the move, and they find that, surprise, surprise, it's hard. They have to save money they'd rather be spending on beer or renting videos at Blockbuster or whatever. They think they're coming to the world I describe in my books and that we're on the brink of revolution right now, and then the months go by and I'm not on TV every night. All they get is emails and suggestions from me about making their own literature and doing things on their own, usually all alone, because we don't have anybody around who'll step forward, so forth and so on, and they get all depressed at the lack of immediate spectacular results, and they say, oh, Harold isn't doing anything, it's all a con, and they quit and they wander away on the internet looking for some other form of racial entertainment. Now, this happens fairly often, I'm sorry to say. Another one of our American white boy character flaws, the demand for instant gratification of every desire, a gratification which I admit that right now I can't provide. So to try and hang on to some of these new people we're getting in after their first 9 months or so, I'm going to ask you guys to email me and tell me flat out, what is it that you want me to do? What is it that you want to see out of the Northwest Front and the Northwest Independence Movement as a whole? Try, if possible, to tailor your envisioned activity to something vaguely consistent with our actual resources, which are limited to the point of being non-existent. Let me know exactly what you want to see out of me and the NF, and I will discuss your ideas and issues on the next few podcasts within the limits of prudence at any rate. Does everyone understand what I'm getting at here? Who knows, maybe some of you guys really can come up with something practical I can do or the group can do to speed things up that none of us have thought of yet. One of the things white nationalists always get accused of is that our cause is one of hate. It's nothing of the kind, of course. Our cause is the survival of our race. But then the media and our lords and masters have never been too interested in the facts of the truth. Knowing the natural propensity of humans to gravitate towards the positive rather than the negative, the Jews have succeeded in calling the good bad and the bad good, and have achieved a monumental propaganda victory by getting the vast majority of the public to believe it. By simply stepping forward through their control of the media, the churches, and other outlets, and declaring what is moral and what is immoral for all the world to hear, they have seized the moral high ground on all issues, especially those dealing with race and culture. Consequently, all those who wish to be moral will seek to obey what's been dictated from on high, not knowing or suspecting that the people who laid down those standards are themselves motivated by almost nothing except hatred for the white race and the civilization that we've created. Unfortunately, most people these days have not developed the adequate knowledge necessary to understand how today's morality has changed from that of history. That indeed most of the famous people of history, from Plato to Thomas Jefferson, would be considered hateful bigots by today's liberal standards. There can be no greater morality than that of the survival of the white race. And yet this is the first age in history where those who hold this viewpoint are widely viewed as evil and immoral, haters. 90 years ago, a politician had a hard time getting elected in the South without Ku Klux Klan support. When the Klan marched, they marched in broad daylight down the streets of major cities to the cheers of an adoring public. At a rally today, 50 or so Klansmen need police protection from the hundreds and thousands of jeering fools and scum. While this has much to do with the declining state of the overall quality of our movement, it also reflects the sheer magnitude of the Jewish victory over our minds. The white peoples of Europe and European descent, more than any other, historically have been the creators, the developers, and the sustainers of civilization, of culture as we know it. Across Europe, vast cathedrals pierced the sky over great cities where white men and women carried out the struggle of their daily lives by striving to make them better through innovation, invention, and plain hard work. They worshiped the God of their forefathers and knew that they, and not the filthy Jews, were the apples of his eye. A light unto the nations and the standard bearers of all that is good and decent and right. Our people, not the Jews. In short, they built a world from the ground up using nothing but their minds and their hands. They spread from sea to sea, then across the sea and back again. When Magellan circled the earth and Cortez conquered the Aztecs with a handful against thousands, and while Gutenberg was inventing movable type so that books could be read by millions, the niggers and the Indians and large parts of Asia were still bogged down in the same primitive aboriginal state of life which existed thousands of years before. The truth is not hatred. It is simply the truth. The truth can never be offensive. It simply is. All right, I feel my voice starting to go, so this one may run a little short. Better get that third music break in. What do I feel in the mood for? Haven't had any clawhammer banjo on here for a while. This is Grandpa Jones.
Judge James was a man who rambled through the land. He robbed many bank and train. He was leader of a band, a bold and wicked band. Many are the people that were slain. Oh, no more Jesse James, no more Jesse James, for they laid poor Jesse in his grave. As he went to turn his head, little Bobby shot him dead, and they laid poor Jesse in his grave. Jesse was an expert shot, his bullets found the spot, his aim was deadly and true. With his pistol by his side, well, he wandered far and wide, as many bull robber men do.
Racial past, there was nothing more sacred than honor, and nothing more priceless than to be counted among the honorable and the truthful. Today we have lost our very souls. Today we are shadows of the men we once were. Instead of going west, we go to the nearest Blockbuster and watch a movie starring some Jew. Instead of being men, we cower like dogs, wondering all the while how our chains came to bind us. Instead of being real Christians, we fawn and prattle over some Judeo-preacher with the slick tongue, stuffing money into his sold-out pockets while he tells us to love and support the wretched Jews who hate the very name of Jesus Christ. The creed that once conquered the world is now Pat Robertson 700 Club crap that slavers over filthy, Christ-hating Jews, all the while asking for money to buy a new Cadillac for some fat televangelist. We are a noble race, a race of philosophers and thinkers, from Plato, Aristotle, and Pythagoras to Thomas Aquinas and Descartes and Swedenborg. We are a race of inventors, from Hero of Alexandria, Da Vinci, Edison, and Bell to the computer pioneers of the modern day. Bill Gates may be an asshole, but he's a white asshole. We are a warrior race, from Alexander the Great, Hannibal, and Julius Caesar to Washington, Napoleon, and Rommel. All these we are, and more. To lift up our accomplishments, which would take volumes uncounted, is to in no way impugn the accomplishments or lack thereof of other races. To regard our achievements with awe, pride, and the inevitable desire to increase upon them is, in fact, the first step to the betterment of our world, because it displays a commitment to truth in this age of lies and deceit. If the white race, this race of warriors, philosophers, artists, and inventors, has been responsible for drastically increasing the standard of living of virtually all of the world's populations, then what morality except pure unadulterated evil could justify our extinction? In truth, the moral high ground is ours, and it is our responsibility to persuade others of this. Is a man called a hater for loving his family more than the family of another? If a man prefers his own wife over another, does this mean he hates all other women? And yet this is the logic our enemies often use when they accuse us of hatred for loving or preferring our racial family more than another. It is up to us to change the public perception of our struggle from one which seeks to destroy to one which will continue to build that grandest of high cultures, the Aryan culture. The racial enemy, the Jews, and their lickspittle lackeys in the media have taken this noblest of all ideals, that of the preservation of God's creation, and turned it into something twisted and evil. They have taken what is perfectly natural and right, the innate propensity of people to prefer their racial kindred, and called it hatred and bigotry. But what if we do hate? Some things and some people deserve to be hated. To hate what is wrong and what does harm to ourselves and to the people we love is a perfectly logical and understandable human reaction. Well, if someone's a hater for hating evil, then I'm a hater. There are not enough haters of vice, sin, and evil in this world. If you built a grand palace and a pack of monkeys invaded the place and befouled it and tore everything up, wouldn't you hate them? Does not a father hate the man who rapes his daughter? There is nothing wrong with hatred if properly placed, but we have to make sure that our Northwest movement is not about hatred. It has to be about building a new society based on the natural and historic order of things. Justice, which is the inevitable consequence of white rule, will occur without the useless fog of fury that clouds the mind in times when a clear mind will be needed the most. There is a thin line between hatred and justice. We have to make sure we never lose sight of it. Thus, our message must always focus on the positive. The future of the world depends on the survival of the white race. Understanding this, it is imperative that those who join and support the Northwest Front begin to rethink their motives, arguments, and overall ways of thinking when dealing with racial issues, and start to regain the moral high ground which has been lost by endless waves of enemy propaganda. We have to understand and communicate to others that our movement is not about unjust hatred, but love for our own. Not about destruction, but about building. Not about death, but life. Not about immorality, but a divine morality summed up in an intense love of God's creation and a desire to maintain what was good and right in the beginning. Well, our time is up, so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Anandban. Freedom.